Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. As we recognize the 20th anniversary of 9/11 through the arts, we wanted to look at the way the day changed the way we look at each other. There's an FBI statistic you may have heard. Hate crimes against Arab and Muslims spiked after 9/11, nearly 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. After the attacks, for months on the news and in the media, there was a constant loop of images of the hijackers who were members of Al-Qaeda, 15 from Saudi Arabia, 2 from the United Arab Emirates, 1 from Lebanon, and 1 from Egypt. You may also remember President Bush made the point that no one should confuse the ideology of the terrorists with the Muslim faith. He said in a speech, quote, "The face of terrorism is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is about. Islam is peace. These terrorists don't represent peace. They represent evil and war. When we think of Islam, we think of a faith that brings comfort to a billion people around the world, and that's made brothers and sisters out of every race." As a reaction to 9/11, there's a lot that's right about that comment. And as my next guest will explain, there are also parts of it that are problematic, as were many of the ways Muslims and Arab folks were written about and depicted post-9/11. Joining me now is Evelyn Asultani, author of Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. Evelyn is an associate professor at the University of Southern California and a scholar of representation of Muslims in U.S. media. She consults film studios and has even helped develop a series of guidelines called the Obeidi Asultani Test. We'll hear about that in a bit. Evelyn, thank you for making time for us.
Thanks, Allison, for having me.
Listeners, if you want to engage in this conversation, we'd love to hear from you. What depictions of Muslims post 9/11 had you shaking your head, or what images have made you feel more hopeful? What did you notice about the way Muslims and Arab folks were represented in the media and arts after 9/11? Do you think it's gotten better or worse? 646-435-7280. You can also tweet to us or send us a message. Same handle for both, at All of It WNYC. So your book is dedicated to your late father, and you've mentioned, you start your TED Talk, actually, discussing your parents and how when people would ask them, where are you from, they would give them an inaccurate answer when they were asked. Why was this?
That's right. I grew up, actually, in New York City with my dad, who was an Iraqi Muslim, and my stepmom, who's a Colombian Catholic. And when I was growing up, people would ask us all the time, where are you from? Where are you from? It was the most common question I received as a child and us as a family. And my father, instead of saying Iraq, would often say Turkey, because it's a secular Muslim country and it seemed more acceptable. And if he said Iraq, he would get questions about terrorism, how he made his money. And then my stepmom got all these questions about drug dealing when she said Colombia. So she would say Spain instead, to just avoid the conversations and the assumptions that people had about them.
Which brings me to my next question. You've studied how stereotypes can, you know, have real world impacts, the things that we see. And aside from people asking questions like that and just being rude and annoying and their microaggressions, what are some of the serious ways these kind of stereotypes make their way into our culture and into our policy?
So one of my colleagues, Professor Muniba Saleem, did a study. And she shows that there's a correlation between consuming images of Muslims as violent and supporting policies that restrict civil liberties for Muslims in the U.S. and also supporting war in Muslim-majority countries. So there is a relationship between the kinds of images we're consuming and then the policies that we're willing to support, many of which have dire consequences for Muslims. A poll that I like to cite to make the point about how powerful media representations are is a poll that was done in 2015 by Public Policy Polling, and it asked Republicans and Democrats if they would favor bombing Agrabah. Agrabah is the fictional city in Aladdin, and 30% of Republicans and 19% of Democrats indicated that they supported bombing Agrabah. So it shows that even fictional places that we don't know of that sound Arab or Muslim are worthy of our bombs. Of course, media is not alone to blame. Media is not the same thing as policy, but it influences how we understand the world. You know, we went to war in Iraq and they had nothing to do with 9/11. 200,000 civilians were killed. The country was decimated. ISIS emerged Did the media do that? No. But we were able to go to war and make the case because of a century of stereotyping and media representations that primed us to support an endeavor like that. On a smaller scale, those of us who are Muslim have to be ready to talk about terrorism, extremism, oppressed women constantly. And media also impacts our self-esteem, how we understand ourselves, other people, our sense of belonging. And just like I like to make the point that it's not the media's fault, it's that media shaping our perceptions. It's also not the problem of one TV show or one film. So mm-hmm. we can't say, oh, it's because of 24, oh, it's because of Homeland, but rather it's about a history of meaning-making about Muslims that has taken place over a century. And the same is not true when we look at people of white European descent in the U.S. So if there's a school shooting, or if we think about the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, we don't then condemn an entire group of people and create policies to target all Irish Catholic men or all white men of a certain age. But when it comes to Arabs and Muslims, because of the history of stereotyping, it's easier to make the case for policies that impact all of us.
My guest is Evelyn Al-Sultani. The name of her book is Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. So you write a post on 11 about the media's tendency to resort to what you called simplified, complex representations. First example is the patriotic Muslim. You noticed that there was a shift in the portrayal of Muslims, that they had to be super patriotic in television shows. Can you share an example and why this trope emerged?
Yes. So after 9/11, we got more terrorist-themed shows, which is to be expected. This huge event happened in the U.S., one that we had never experienced before. So media writers and producers were ripping through headlines and creating stories about terrorism. But some civil rights groups, like the Council on American-Islamic Relations and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, were concerned what would the impact be on the public in the middle of a war on terror if we saw more and more images of Arabs and Muslims as terrorists. So they met with the writers and producers of 24, and the result is the inclusion of a patriotic Arab or Muslim character. And in my book, I say this has become standardized, that mm-hmm. after 9/11, chances are if you're watching a movie or a TV show and there's an Arab or Muslim terrorist in the plot, then the writers and producers will include a patriotic Arab or Muslim character, seemingly to counteract the potential impact of the stereotype. So we get a lot of CIA agents and FBI agents who are Muslim. Some examples are, there was a show on Showtime right after 9/11 called Sleeper Cell. Mm-hmm. And there was a character called Darwin El Sayed. He was a black Muslim FBI agent who was infiltrating a sleeper cell. On 24, we had the character Nadia, who worked for the counterterrorism unit. On Quantico, we have the twin sisters, Nima and Reina. And on Homeland, we had Farah Shirazi, who was an Iranian Muslim woman who wore the hijab. She was part of the CIA team. And during her time on Homeland, she proves that she is patriotic, and at the very end, she's killed by the hands of a Muslim terrorist. So she makes the ultimate sacrifice, and she's willing to give her life and die for the U.S. So many of these characters are so patriotic that they are proving that they are American, they are proving that they belong in America, and they're willing to give their lives to prove it. So on the one hand, it is an expansion in representations. They're not all terrorists. Look, some of them are good. But in my book, I ask the question of what does it mean to have such a narrow conception of mm-hmm. patriotism? After 9/11, there are many debates. What is patriotism? Is it agreeing with everything the government does, supporting all of the policies? Is it challenging the government to ensure democracy, to ensure that we're not demonizing and criminalizing an entire group of people? So that's one criticism, that in order to be a good Muslim, you have to conform to a very narrow conception of patriotism. And then at the same time, the other problem is that we're getting stories about terrorism, and then Arabs and Muslims are good or bad mm-hmm. in the context of terrorism. And what we really need is lots of stories outside of the context of terrorism, so that the terrorism story is just one out of many.
Yeah, it's interesting, this post 9/11 terrorism drama. You mentioned 24 and Sleeper Cell. So I want to play the trailer of Sleeper Cell, and I'm going to give people, I'm sure you've seen this, these images of like maps of Saudi Arabia and mosques and SWAT teams over this soundtrack. It's 30 seconds. Let's play it, and we can talk about it on the other side.
I know what I do is right. I live for God. I will die for God, and I will kill for God.
Sleeper Cell on AXN Crime.
Oh boy. So with shows like that and trailers like that, I remember this thing with Homeland. Somebody just put on our Slack, oh my God, after hearing that. I remember in the Homeland, which seemed like a pretty sophisticated show, angered people, some people because of the way it depicted Arabs and Muslims. And, you know, after all, its main character was galvanized after 9/11, Carrie. Some activists took it into their hands. They were hired to write graffiti on a backdrop of a scene, and they wrote in Arabic, Homeland is racist, and it aired. I'm sort of curious about your take on this form of protest.
It was an incredible form of protest, and I know a lot of Muslims and Arabs and South Asians watching the show were cheering that those who were making the show hired people to do the graffiti to make it look quote-unquote authentic, and then those who were hired wrote those kinds of messages to highlight how the show was perpetuating stereotypes. And Homeland, on the one hand, which many shows today that deal with terrorism, they are more complicated than 2 decades ago. They criticize U.S. foreign policy. They talk about drone strikes. They give backstories to terrorist characters. But it doesn't really help us move forward when we have the same depiction of Muslims in the context of terrorism over and over again. But I thought that form of resistance was very effective. It got a lot of attention, and it definitely made a lot of people feel vindicated.
My guest is Professor Evelyn Asseltani. We're talking about Arab and Muslim representation in the media post 9/11. And I want to continue with this idea that you write about quite extensively in your book, Simplified Complex Representations. Another example you have is the oppressed woman. You write in your book, quote, "You scoured news stories published in Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, as well as news shows aired on CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, with a focus on the first year after September 11th. The result is an abundance of stories about the oppressed Muslim woman. Consider a sampling of post 9/11 headlines: Lifting the Veil, Free to Choose, Unveiling Freedom, Under the Veil, Beneath the Veil, and An Unveiled Threat." So when you were looking at these pieces, what was the point of all of these pieces? And if we're going to be generous, what is the unintended consequence of investigating Muslim women's lives in this way?
Yeah. So after 9/11, everyone wanted to know, why did this happen? And a lot of journalists went to the veil to say it's this mysterious thing. And if we look behind it, it was very overgeneralized, as if all Muslim women are oppressed, as opposed to really being specific about certain contexts. But it was posed as if it would answer the question, why do they hate us? Was the question that emerged? Well, they oppress their women, they want freedom, they can't have it, and that's why they hate us. It was a very simplistic answer, and it didn't give us the reasons that have been cited. A lot of them have to do with U.S. foreign policies or about living under authoritarian regimes and various factors that come together to lead someone to commit an act of violence like terrorism. But there's this obsession with stories about oppressed Muslim women. And when I was doing the research for that chapter, I read so many headlines that I felt sick. And I thought, if I'm a Muslim woman reading these headlines and I feel completely sickened, upset, disgusted on a visceral level, how are other people feeling who don't really know anything about Islam? So part of my argument in that chapter is that when we get these stories that are upsetting, we remember them. They're horrible. But then the good stories about women who are successful, about people who are contributing to their societies, they don't have the same kind of visceral impact, and they're easily forgettable. So the story about the quote-unquote oppressed Muslim women has a lot of emotional impact, and it has been used to justify going to war in Afghanistan, going to war in Iraq. I would say not in genuine terms.
Let's talk about people trying to make change. Actor Riz Ahmed, who's actually going to be on our show on Monday, when he was nominated for an Oscar last year for his role in Sound of Metal, every article mentioned that he was the first Muslim to be named for Best Actor in the Academy Awards, to be nominated. And if you go to the top of his Twitter page, he has a piece of video pinned. Let's listen.
I ask myself, if I'm the exception to the rule, what must the rule be about people like me? What must the unwritten rule be about Muslims, a quarter of the world's population, and their place in our stories, our culture, and their place in our society, if any? But I'm here to briefly tell you that exceptions don't change the rules. Exceptions, if anything, highlight the rule, and in some ways allow us to be complacent about leaving that rule in place. The progress that's being made by a few of us doesn't paint an overall picture of progress if most of the portrayals of Muslims on screen are still either non-existent or entrenched in those stereotypical, toxic, two-dimensional portrayals. I think we're going to look back at this period of misrepresentation with the same shame and sadness that we look upon minstrelsy in days gone by. It's something that has to be changed, and it's something that we can't change on our own. It's a structural problem. We have to join hands. What rewrites rules isn't exceptions, but it's when the oppressed and the oppressors, whether they're aware of being oppressors or aware of their complicity in the oppression or not, join hands, open their eyes, and make a solemn commitment to take some concrete steps. But maybe that's not just a Muslim struggle. Maybe that's all of our struggle as storytellers to afford all of us that empathy and that humanity.
So he started a grant for Muslim filmmakers. And you and Sue Obeidi, the director of Muslim Public Affairs Council, the Hollywood Bureau, you've created this Obeidi al-Sultani test, which is a little bit like the Bechdel test for women in film. What are some of the criteria that you would like to see content creators consider?
So I should mention that there's also a Riz test out of the UK named after Riz Ahmed that identifies common tropes like oppression of women and terrorists. But where the Obeidi al-Sultani test comes in is that we've noticed that writers and producers are making efforts. And a lot of these efforts have emerged after Donald Trump announced his idea for a Muslim ban. There was concerted effort to challenge Donald Trump's brand of white nationalism. And so we've started to see just in the last 4 years an expansion of representations of Muslims that we've never seen before. I don't know where it's going. I don't know if it'll last. But we were talking about what an amazing moment this is, but that a lot of the representations tend, not all, but some of them tend to fall short, either because people on the staff don't know anything about Muslims or the way that they're thinking about diversifying. You know, perhaps there are other ways to think about it. So we came up with this test to help media makers think about approaching how do we approach diversity as a culture and diversifying representations of Muslims.
We've got about 45 seconds left, so I'm going to ask you to just list them real quick.
Okay. No old tropes. So we don't have to go back to terrorism and Orientalism. Avoiding mistakes by having a Muslim identifying writer on staff. Not defining Muslims only by their religion. We can have multiple identities. Having a character with a strong presence rather than just throwing someone in the background to say that you have a Muslim an actor. Having diverse backgrounds and identities, having Black Muslims, Indonesian Muslims. There's so many of us from all over the world, so diversifying who Muslims are on screen.
I suggest you watch Evelyn al-Sultani's TED Talk and check out her book, Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. Evelyn, thank you so much for sharing your work and taking the time today.
Thanks so much, Allison.
This is All of It.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.